Chapter 5, I Libertine.
"What is it, sir?"
said Lance, bending over the bed solicitously. Verrobridge kept his eyes closed, but some of the pain left his face.
"Nothing. My tea's cold."
Lance looked at him for a long moment and said,
"Why are you telling me this unhappy tale?"
What?
Verrobridge blinked up at him.
"Why, I've told you. For my sake, because ultimately a man must confess to himself the stature of his follies. For your sake, because you must be warned. I smell it in the breeze, in the tack you've taken. You have set a course, eh? I'd not be able to dissuade you from it."
Respectfully but firmly, Lance agreed. Verrobridge shrugged.
"There you are, then. If you will not avoid the enemy, you must know him."
"Or join him,"
Lance amended, and smiled.
"Ah, well, well,"
huffed the old man.
"Yes, there's that. But then you must know him even better, eh?"
"I shall put the kettle on," said Lance, "and I think I'll nip down while it's boiling and send the boy round to fetch Piggott and the carriage. Have I your leave?"
Verrobridge looked at him with amusement.
"You please me, boy. You do indeed. You need my permission about as urgently as you need my scrofula, and well you know it. And you know I know it. Nay, what you're saying is that if I've a yarn to spin, I'd best get on with it and be done, because you want to be on your way to Lady Blanton's. I read you well, lad, I read you well. Mind that you never let another human being read you as I do."
"I shall put the kettle on, sir,"
said Lance again, and went out.
"And did you do your task, sir?"
asked Lance when they were settled again.
"That I did. The church was at Lainston, in Hampshire. And if you've never heard of Lainston, you're no different from me 20 years ago. I rode to Aldershot the very day Miss Chudley visited me, slept at an inn, and was off for Lainston early in the morning. I recalled it like a bad dream. I needn't tell you that my life's works have mostly been accomplished at the other end of my spine, and riding a Mazurka-gated hire horse at a canter for most of 2 days did little for my good humour. I remember missing the track a number of times, once to find myself face to face with a fingerboard directing me to Nether Wallop. I give you my word, I wheeled and walloped away from there. Lainston's not far from Winchester, and close by the River Itchen, yet once there you'd believe yourself on another planet, or at least another age. The church is one of those English indestructibles, where the new chancel was put up in Anno Domini 943, and the rest of the building was flung up by the mound builders. The living must bring the curate all of £4 per annum. I found him in the churchyard, on his four bones pulling weeds. He was a saint-faced youngster with eyes all watery from years of staring at irregular Hebrew verbs. I came up at a gallop and wheeled my mount and slid off all dusty and grim. I identified myself briskly as Lascombe, exemplification officer of the Protonotary's office, Canthab. Jingled my fobs in his face and demanded to know if his parish register had been monished.
Lance straightened up.
Monished?
A word I'd invented on the way down. It smacks of correction and punishment, and it seems to me to sound like a word one ought to know.
Yes, so it does.
It did to him too, the poor chap. "Oh, dear," he said, in that dove coo which so often results from the mixture of goat cheese with scholarship. "Why," he says, "I don't, I can't, oh, dear." So I marched him to his little sacristy and had him take down the registers for the past 50 years, telling him sternly, a third of the registers in England remained unmonished, and the bishop is not pleased. Oh, dear, he cooed. And off I sent him to his weeds, with a faithful promise I'd have every book monished good as new by noon. So, off he went, grateful as can be. The rest was simple. I'd 4 vials of ink with me, all different and ready to be used or blended, and 12 quills sharpened 12 ways. Luck gave me a blank half-page just where I needed it, and there, in what I flatter myself is the old vicar's hand, with what is indistinguishably his own quill, I put the entry of August 12, 1744, Augustus Hervey and Elizabeth Chutley. And there it stands, I'm sure, to this very day. I send my compliments and news over to Miss Chudley as soon as I returned. Spent most of the next 4 days plucking the hairs out of my nostrils and re-blocking my wig, and kindred activities. At length a boy came with the message. I'm to say the word Lainston, and you're to come with me. And I had my horse brought, and followed the boy on his ancient white mare. The boy spoke never a word until we reached the edge of Kensal Green, where in those days an old livery stood. It was deserted, but not abandoned, a tight old structure, which has since burnt down, doubtless from the burning shame I carried at the thought of it. The boy then said, "You're to wait here," and rode off down Harrow Road. That was the last I saw of him. I dismounted and stood in the gloom. It was after tea-time and growing dark, feeling that I must be the only illuminated thing in the dark landscape, and with all my intentions lit up for the world to read as well. And then I began to feel as if I'd been made the butt of a joke, would be left standing there until St. Swithin's Eve. But I heard a tapping and stood off from the building to look up at it, and there in a bit of a round window in the upper story I saw a fluttering white handkerchief. I led my horse round the building and tied him in an L away from the road, and tried the doors until I found one which yielded. I stood blinking inside until I became aware of a horn lanthorn standing on the floor, making a little ring of dim light on the boards at the foot of the ladder. Lance, oh, Lance, I'd not be recalling all these details or relating them if it were easy to think of what followed. So up I went to Milady's boudoir, that it was a dusty feed store, and there was Milady, barely to be discerned. And her peignoir was a riding habit, stiff and high-necked, with a great covering skirt, and her scented couch a mass of straw with a clean horse blanket thrown across it. Her act of welcome was a single billow of the habit which readied her. Her word of love was, "Go on, then," in a flat, cold voice. Well, no gentleman could have proceeded from that point. No gentleman, for that matter, would have found himself in such a circumstance. I, however, was not, and am not, a gentleman. And proceed I did, shambling and self-aware like a schoolboy taking a dare. It was a chilling experience. I had not, of course, expected ardency. Wait, lad, wait. I am lying to both of us. I had expected ardency. Everything I am, everything I came from, quivers in awareness of its low station, and this very lowliness demanded a response. Failing ardency, I suppose distaste would have been a response. Fear would have been a response. Disgust, nausea, even terror, anything. But there was no response. It ended because I could bear that no longer, and for no other reason. Do you follow me? I knelt there a-nostriling out my temper like a foundered horse while she calmly rose, a simple act which, unassisted, dressed her decently for the street. I saw her moving toward the ladder and gasped out that she must wait. She stopped and waited. "Certainly Barrowbridge," she said. It had been Mr. Barrowbridge at our first meeting. I pulled myself together, got straightened up, and went to her. "We made a bargain," I told her. "I fear I let myself be angry. What is it Balthazar says about anger?"
"It is the most difficult to halt while running at the double," Lance quoted.
"True enough, but I was thinking of every onset of passion is a digression from rational conduct. That's the one I proved that day. I, and like a student with a theorem, gave proof of my proof. So, like a farmer haggling over a cracked pot at the Haymarket, I said, 'We made a bargain.' 'We kept it,' she said. 'What, that?' I said in rage. 'Just so,' she said, 'and the first I know I'm advancing on her is when she sets the lash of her riding crop against my breastbone. Did you know you can hold back a man there, 3 times your weight that way?' 'Listen to me, Barrowbridge,' she said, in a voice like hailstones melting in the back of your collar. 'I'll deign to explain myself to you just once, only once. 'Twas yourself who made this act a matter of commerce, not I. You name the price and you collect it. What else you expected, I neither know nor care. I am morally certain, however,' she said, 'that when you spend a sixpence for a purchase, you pay out the money itself and do not wrap the coin in cloth of gold. You'd no right to ask anything more than the price you'd set. You'd little right to ask even that of a desperate client who would get help nowhere else and wouldn't have the time to if there was another place. As to the transaction itself, any simpleton knows that if I buy Mary's radishes, I want her radishes more than I do my money, else I shouldn't buy. She in turn wants my money more than she wants her radishes. In any trade, I want to get a bit more than I give. In this," she nods toward the horse blanket, "I could get nothing from you. I had then no choice but to give less than nothing." "Then you confess you had me in Lainston and back for nothing?" I bellowed at her. "I so confess," she said with a glint in her eye. "I did it because I thought of a way, even as you would happily take anything I have without paying anything important for it. But you can't think how to do it." "Take care," she said suddenly. She must have seen something in my face, for by then I was fair livid. "I warn you, Barrowbridge," she said, "take care. We have had one interchange. I call us even up, and you are bellowing in pain. Do anything else to me, and we'll be even again on the instant, with you bellowing louder. That will happen, and happen until you agree with me on what even up means. Lance, have you ever seen a great hulking ox of a fellow going about all day, knocking littler men about, just to prove he's a great hulking ox? So it is with the behavior of fools, who can be depended upon for a greater folly each time someone proves them to be foolish. I went for her, I confess. I lifted this hand to a woman. Lift it, I made a cannon of myself, and fired the fist at her like an iron ball."
Barrowbridge lay breathing hard then.
"And she wasn't there,"
he whispered, face echoing the exact amazement of that long-gone day.
"She melted away into the shadows at the side, and head first, down the ladder hole I went. My hand clawed a moment at the nigh edge, but she must have been waiting for just that, for she fetched me such a lick with her riding crop on the back of my hand that she took out a piece the size of a Dutch dollar. The next thing I knew, I was opening my eyes on her as she bent near me and took up the lantern. We were on the ground floor. She composed as a cantata, and I a sprawl and broken on the boards. "It's even up again, Barrow Bridge," she told me sweetly, "and you've nothing to fear, but make no other gesture, or you'll have the like of this again, and again after that, if you're fool enough, world without end." And she blew out the light. I heard the split door open and close quietly, and then, I do believe, I fainted.
Lance made a small noise that was not a word.
Small wonder you wanted to warn me.
I've told ye only the first part, the smallest,
croaked the old man.
Lad, never fear. I'll not keep you all night with the rest. The rest took longer, but takes less telling. When I was up and about with a chip out of my pelvis, and who's to know how much that contributed to my present state as the years got on, and had dislocated a wrist in order again, I was not a well man, and I vowed I would not be until I taught Elizabeth Chutley what I took even up to mean. I had one thing with which to belabour her, and that was the task I'd fulfilled in Lainston. I'd not dare to mention that, of course, and involve myself, but the facts behind it, the marriage itself, that could trouble her a great deal, especially now that the sick Earl was well. You go about waving proofs of things held secret, and you'll cause trouble. This truism applies as well to open secrets. I made a short list of influential folk, clerks to MPs, nameless folk who had the ear of the church and the like, and made the rounds with my authenticated rumour. Elizabeth Chudley was indeed wed to Augustus John Hervey. It would spread and widen, and at length some enemy she had would take the trouble to go to Lainston and see the records, and the rumour would be truth, and the whole structure she had built would totter. Or, so I deluded myself. On the first day of this campaign, I passed the word to four people. On the second day, I went to a chap called St. George, who's a printer in the firm which does the monthly review, and gave him my item, being quite sure he'd pass it along to someone in the club. "Ah, yes," he said, "not an hour ago another chap was in here with proof positive she wed young Pulteney, Earl of Bath, 4 years ago, and he laughed in my face. Not a little taken aback, I trotted around to the Fish and Staff on Fleet Street, where so many great of the time dined, and had a word with the innkeeper. Yes, he'd heard my tale of Bristol's brother. He'd heard it, matter of fact, 4 times since last midnight. 4 separate people had told him the same about Bath, and there was a powerful rumour about the Duke of Hamilton, who had been a great admirer of Elizabeth Chudley in the early days, that he had married her as well. I ran about London like a zealot, with an end-of-the-world revelation, wild-eyed and laughed at. It came to me far too late that Elizabeth Chudley, with 20 times the resources I could command, 10 times the vindictiveness, and, I now confess, 2x the intelligence, was spreading my story for me, 13 to the dozen, until it became an old joke, an absurdity, and for good measure she was spreading yarns about others as well, so no one would know what to believe. Oh, the following day I received a letter from her. It was unsigned, but it was unquestionably hers. It only said, 'On guard,' in cheerful script, and while I stood there turning it over in my hands and wondering what it was I must be on guard against, a great hairy bailiff came whacking on my door with the news that my lease had been held invalid, and that I must vacate. Even the extent of my knowledge of the technicalities of rental could not save me, and out I went. I settled again soon elsewhere. 4 ruddy times I settled, but there was no escaping her implacable pursuit. There was nothing to connect her with any of it, and nothing was ever done past the bounds of profound nuisance. But so many things, so many different things. I'll swear she was responsible for a basket of rotten eggs delivered to me one day, and another delivery, would you believe, a pack of hunting dogs, howling and hungry, ordered by someone who had forged my signature. Aye, and the statement with them, £68.12.6, payable on the spot. Removing so abruptly made it nigh impossible for clients to find me. Those who did began to slip away, usually for reasons not divulged to me. They simply did not return. I collared one on the street one day, a chap who was attempting an action to keep his brother out of debtor's prison for £18. Someone had given him £18, a simple device. So I came to Bermondsey in this muck and mud, and not long afterwards I received another of the short, cheerful missives. Even up again, it said. And thereafter she let me be.
She is a witch.
A cheerful witch, though,
Barrowbridge agreed.
A joyous, cheerful, resourceful, unforgiving witch. I'll say this of her. She gives warning, and she announces surcease, and sticks to both. I think it's a matter of principle. Now then, I've had my say. I've bared my soul. I trust warned you sufficiently. I wish I could say I've warned you away altogether, but I can see I have not.
As usual, Lance said reverently, "you are quite right, sir."
Barrowbridge laughed at him.
"Damn you," he said affectionately. "Tell me, Lanky, what you've planned for her. Mayhaps I can be of some assistance."
"Would you, sir, would you really, even if it helped her?"
The old man looked at him gravely.
"'Twas more than a quip, Lanky, when I told you of my death. I'm a hulk now, helpless in this bed and on that chair. I've known these past 12 months or more that I've overstayed my tenure at the head of this organization of ours. I'd never ask you for a pension, and you'd be a fool to give it to me. I've made you earn your porch twice over. You've every right to expect the same of me. I can no longer do anything for myself by commanding you. You can, I think, do a great deal for yourself by commanding me."
"Ah, sir,"
cried Lance, quite overcome.
"Before you make that fine straight spine of yours all soggy with an excess of emotion,"
said the old man acidly,
"let me add, with the death of my dignity, a number of other qualities are now deceased. Most notably, my foolishness. At long last freed from that lifelong curse, I may say here and now I am no longer a fool, and I know clearly that the instant I become a hindrance to you, you'll drop me like a hot brick."
"Never."
"Nonsense, boy. 'Tis the way I raised you, and the way I want you to be. Now, to work. Tell me your plans."
At the top of the High Street, Southwark, Piggott wheeled to the side and stopped. He opened the boot, found the folded cloak, and tossed it to his pensive passenger.
"Here's the bridge, Lanky, and I time the bug become a butterfly."
Silently, Lance shrugged out of his drab covering and took the fine cloak. He handed up the old one, rather obviously leaving it for Pigott to fold. Pigott did and put it away.
"Want the scutcheon, or is one alone worse than none?"
Lance seemed not to hear him, but sat looking out across the dark Thames. He felt exceeding strange, and had been silent and troubled since he had put the old barrister to sleep and gone to his inn to change. The day had been eventful, full of victories for itself and possibilities for the morrow. But in this hiatus he was plagued by doubts. The doubts did not go too deep. His inner confidence was that he would command the situation he was coming to as he had the one he had left. What manner of woman yielded up her supposed utmost with such cold casualness as this witch? There was a moralistic response to such a question, of course, but it would derive from a code, and a code is a cipher, a set, fixed attitude to be manipulated without thought. Detached, he set aside prejudice and looked simply at sequences of actions. The classical conduct of women was to withhold the ultimate as a reward. Romance and respectability aside, that was the sum and substance of the interaction between men and women. The theory seemed to be, at its boldest, that the woman who yields is thenceforward without resources, and that therefore it is to her advantage to promise and withhold as long as the revenue continues. Elizabeth Chudley's vivid history might be a demonstration of this principle at work, unless one had Barrowbridge's extraordinary tale to measure it against. With that, one could wonder if she had used that erstwhile ultimate again as punishment instead of reward, as how many ways might she have used it?
"Blarst thee, lad! If you don't want to talk to me at all, you could say so, and I'll stop making a fool of myself."
"What? What's that?" Lance had a long way to come out of his thoughts, and he did it slowly.
"I'm asking, do you want the ruddy scutcheon on the one side? If you don't want to gab with me, you could nod your bleeding head."
Slowly, Lance reached into his great pocket and drew out the missing scutcheon. Wall-eyed, Pigott took it.
"You've had a new... Wait, it's the same one. Lanky, where did you..."
"Buckle it on," said Lance testily. The feel of the carved wood in his hand had brought back his conjectures with a rush, and he needed to be with them. The escutcheon meant Miss Axelrood, and the thought of Miss Axelrood proved to him that in fumbling through the moral wilderness of Miss Chudley's axe, it had not been Miss Chudley he had been thinking about at all. He had been quite ready to accept the fact that Miss Axelrood's visit had not been prompted only by his personal magnetism. He found now, rather to his surprise, that he had been clinging to the idea that some of her conduct, at least, had been the result of some such feeling. He gave her the same test he had made Barrowbridge apply. Could she have secured the desired results in any other way? He rebuilt the situation in his mind accordingly, seeing her make her plea on Miss Chudley's behalf, without the accompanying intimacies. And he dourly confessed to himself, she would have failed. And this is the route through which he reached a real understanding of his good fortune in having Barrowbridge as his personal tactician. Aye, and here was Miss Axelrood with just such a mentor. He visualized, in a mad, vivid flash, Miss Chudley, dressed scandalously as at the legendary ball, and Mr. Barrowbridge, dressed mythically in what ever might denote an exemplification officer of the Prothonotary's office, Cantab, saluting one another with foils, preparing to fence. And one foil was a nameless bastard who wished only to climb and climb until he came to the level from which he had been so cruelly dropped. And the other foil, an incalculable damsel whose dream it was merely to climb and climb. He shook himself violently, He was unsuited and unaccustomed to having visions. He found himself face to face with a coachman, who, having attached the ensigns, was leaning over the step and staring into his face like one trying to identify a sleeping stranger.
"Dash it all, Piggott," snapped Lance. "You've been eating raw onions."
"Shallots," corrected Piggott. "You are in a happy frame, I must say."
Lance glanced at him, and the coachman glared right back. There was no quailing this time, as the chemical of terror was lacking in the younger man, and his mien was only irritated and irritating. But with the contact he came at last to the here and now, to Piggott, the shape of Piggott, and Piggott's function in life, and in this particular episode in it.
He recalled the coachman's discursive warning, all the way through Southwark and Bermondsey, last night, against Miss Axelrood, and how timely his estimates of Miss Chudley had been. Coincidence? Possibly. Piggott's interests were Catholic, and his monologues could treat with anything. Why not this? Then, in the same instant in which this facile excuse came to him, he rejected it. There was a time in the affairs of a man when complications overwhelm him, and he can abide no more mysteries. In the past 24 hours he had been through enough, accomplished enough to drain anyone of psychic energy, and he had at least as exhausting an occasion before him. He had no resources to waste on tact or reasoning in the matter of minor mysteries. All this overload came out in a steel-edged tone, and the words he flung in the coachman's face.
"So you don't know who stole the escutcheon?"
"I don't know who stole the escutcheon,"
snarled the coachman, giving an accurate, though cockney, mimicry.
"Now, don't be telling me your highness is raising his ruddy gallbladder over a rotten little piece of wood. Besides, you got it back, so where's the mucking loss? Who had it, anyhow?"
"Miss Axelrood had it. She unbuckled it standing right there on the step last night, right under our noses."
"Now, there's a sly little package. I never would have guessed."
"I believe that, Piggott. I also believe it to be your only innocence in this matter."
"How's that?"
demanded Piggott, cocking his head as if to hear better.
"I'll not fence with you at all," said Lance sharply. "I'll charge you with having disclosed my address to a stranger, and with it all my affairs. I charge you with risking my safety and my future for less than Judas got, without the Iscariot excuse of not fully knowing what he was about."
"I don't know what you're maundering about, and I doubt you do yourself."
"Then I'll make it clear," said Lance, angry and weary. "Miss Axelrood was at the inn, inside my room, waiting for me when I got there last night. The only person who could have conceivably told her where I was is Simon Barrowbridge, and I have excellent reason to believe him innocent. How much did she give you, Piggott?" "It must have been a good bit. Grove had 2 gold sovereigns for his part in it."
"She was there before us?"
"Oh, come off it," said Lance disgustedly. "Yes, she came by Westminster Bridge in a spring-trap, with a fine black gelding, while you crept through Southwark, talking filthy and not minding your business. Now, if you're willing, drive me to Lady Blanton's. If you're not, I'll take a hackney. Which is it?"
Piggott stepped back to the curb. Surprisingly, his anger seemed to have evaporated in favour of wonderful amazement.
"Lanky, you've an evil way of joking with a man."
"Will you do one thing or the other?" Lance spat. "I've found you out, and I will not talk about it. Not a word."
And with that he plumped back to his seat and folded his arms. Piggott opened his mouth to speak and closed it again. He still, Lance noticed out of the corner of his eye, affected this posture of astonishment. He was not impressed.
He had frequently seen Barrowbridge rehearsing a client in something of the sort. Piggott seemed turned to scan the black river and then the bridge. A hackney was clopping toward them out of London town. The sight of it seemed to stir Piggott into decision, for he snorted and sprang up, whipped the horses so that the near one reared, hitting the traces a frightful jolt. Then they were rumbling across the bridge. Lance braced his legs and set his jaw against the jolting, let his anger bubble in his blood. He found himself enjoying it. He wondered if this enjoyment was what old Barrowbridge had meant so long ago when he said, "A heady thing to know you're right. It comes seldom." Not a word was said between them until they reached a point a few yards from Clerkwell Road in Holborn, and perhaps a quarter mile from Blatton House, and there the carriage stopped.
"Well?"
cried Lance, testy as a dowager. Piggott leaned close.
"Now you listen to me, laddie buck. I'm going to speak the entire bloody truth, and if you don't believe it, I got no more to say, now or ever."
"Very well, if it's the truth. If not, do not bother."
"Oh, it's the truth, and that is, I never told nobody nothing about you. I never saw a farthing from a living soul for informing, especially not informing on you. I haven't and wouldn't. What's going to happen to the pair of us now, I haven't thought out yet, but I will. But you bloody better know what's the truth when you hear it. That's me last word on this."
"Take me to Blanton House,"
said Lance disgustedly. Piggott did, sitting very straight, a far more decent figure, furious than he ever had been before. At Blanton House, Lance waited for the final rumble of his wheels to cease, and then stood abruptly. In a soft, intense voice, designed to be inaudible to the Blanton footman, he said to Piggott,
"You've much latitude, old man. Sit and think over the whole childish story while I am inside. If by the time I come out, an hour perhaps, you are prepared to tell me that you did what I've charged you with, why you did it, and what you expect to do to make amends, well, then I can decide what to do with you. If you insist in flying in the face of reason and evidence, then simply don't be here when I come out. I shall never want to see your face again."
Piggott neither moved nor spoke. Lance alighted and ran up the steps. When he was admitted and the doors closed behind him, Piggott bowed his head. He sat without moving for a very